to introduce Professor Jackie Eales, President of the HA. Jackie is Professor of Early Modern History at Canterbury Christ Church, and her work on the English gentry in the Civil War really challenged the traditional, sort of more localised interpretations of the gentry, arguing that religious networks provided an alternative and national set of allegiances. And her book, The Harleys of Brampton Bryan, was runner-up for the very prestigious World Historical Whitfield Prize, so it was a good read. She was also co-convener of History UK before becoming president of the HA at the AGM last year. And so she's done a year with us. She's already been to many branches, and I know she's got many more lined up, and she's been fantastic. So today, Jackie will be looking at how Charles I developed his image as the people's matter. So will you please welcome Jackie Eales.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I am mic'd up, so I hope you can hear me at the back. If you can't, let me know. I hope you're also tweeting. Now, historians are generally agreed that Charles I was more popular in death than in life. The cult of the martyr king began as soon as his head was severed from his body on 30th of January 1649. The crowd pushed forward to dip their handkerchiefs and other cloth in the blood of the king. And this is a typical image from the period of the execution, as it was imagined perhaps by people who hadn't seen it, but it does give us an idea of how the crowd pressed forward. So I want to take you back to that point in time when Charles was executed and the decade before that and what led up to the execution. The power of these relics that were created when Charles was executed was soon validated by reports of miraculous cures. Most notable of these was the case of Mary Bailey, the Maid of Deptford, who was the subject of three anonymous pamphlets in 1649. And she'd been cured of blindness by being touched with a cloth that had been dipped in Charles's blood, supposedly. More famously, the cult was sustained by the publication of the king's book, the Icon Basilica. The icon comprised Charles I's justification of his actions in civil wars, interspersed with prayers and meditations. And it was on sale within days of the execution. It was rushed out into press. So here's the book, and it was produced in different formats. So there were large folio editions, but there were also small sort of pocket-sized editions that people could carry around and read. Now, during his trial and on the scaffold, Charles I skillfully presented himself as the defender of his people against unlawful authority. He emphasised that Parliament had no legal jurisdiction, and he emphasised that his trial didn't just concern him, but also the freedom and liberty of the people of England. And as he said, "For if power without law may make laws, may alter the fundamental laws of the kingdom, I do not know what subject he is in England that can be sure of his life, or anything that he calls his own." And he continued in this vein on the scaffold when he said that if he had given in to an arbitrary way, for to have all laws changed according to the power of the sword, I need not to have come here, and therefore I tell you that I am the martyr of the people. So this was a very powerfully constructed idea that Charles was a martyr, dying for the liberties and freedoms of his people. And the cult soon became commercialised. So we've got rings, we've got medallions, badges, lockets, all bearing the image of the king, and they were available for purchase by loyalists. And this is a ring you can see with Charles's image on it. Inside there's a little skull and the date of the execution. Sometimes these rings were produced so that you flipped open the top, so it was like a locket and it was closed, but the image of the king was inside, so it was more concealed than that. And I had the pleasure of going to an exhibition of these small items about 2 or 3 years ago at a very upmarket jeweller's in Mayfair. And they produced the catalogue and they were selling it on behalf of charity. But there are a number of items like this. There are also items, small scraps of cloth from the shirt that Charles was said to have worn on the scaffold, some of his hair that had been clipped off. And as I went in with my son and we bought the catalogue, gentleman selling it to me said, we've got a very important visitor this afternoon. It was a very small shop front. At the front, they were selling their jewellery they normally sell. And at the very back, they had a very small area with these items in cases. And in one case, in the centre, there were several items, and it was all encased in glass. So if you were looking at this item there, you would be looking directly at the other people looking in on the other side. And so I glanced up to see who was there, and it was Prince Charles. And I thought, I don't really want to go muscle in on Prince Charles looking at these relics from his ancestors. So I sort of waited until he finished, because it was just cheek by jowl in there. But it was a very bizarre, it was an almost surreal experience. So we've got rings, we've got lockets, this is the sort of thing that was on display in that exhibition, and this is quite intricate. It's got various sort of Latin motto, it's got saying, I live and die in loyalty on it. So it's got little mottos on it to prove that you're loyal to the king. Now, such items were produced well into the Restoration period. This is a medallion, bronze medallion, by Rertier that was produced around about 1670. So this would have been relatively cheap to buy as well. From 1661, the 30th of January, was also officially observed as a fast day by the Church of England. The popularity of the cult helped to keep the royalist cause alive until the Restoration itself. Yet Charles himself has a well-established reputation for disliking popularity. Judith Richards argued that it is common knowledge that between 1625 and 1641, Charles systematically distanced himself from his subjects. More recently, Richard Cust has shown how Charles disapproved of politicians and clerics who courted popularity to the detriment of social order and royal power. In his great survey of the personal rule in the 1630s, however, the late Kevin Sharp disagreed with Richards. He argued that Charles did not ignore public ceremony, and that his royal progresses were not as limited as she had claimed. And Sharp developed these things more fully in his latest book on Charles I, Image Wars, in 2010. The American historian Mark Kishlansky also published an extensive refutation of Richard's thesis, and he argued that instead Charles was the most visible of early modern monarchs. Indeed, Kishlansky insisted that Charles' reputation as an aloof and untrustworthy ruler should be replaced with an alternative characterisation. Charles was both accessible to the political elite and a flexible ruler who was willing to compromise with his critics. Now, historians may not agree about the king's cultivation of his people's affections before the civil wars, but there is general agreement that from 1642 onwards, Charles was forced to make a direct appeal to all of his subjects for their support. So it's not just the political elite that he has to deal with. And this morning, I want to examine the ways in which Charles appealed for his subjects' love, loyalty, and obedience in the 1640s. How did he position himself as the defender of his people? And in particular, how did Charles respond to the rise of the Levellers and the New Model Army, who placed the people at the heart of political rhetoric between 1647 and 1649? Kevin Sharp suggests that the Grand Remonstrance of 1641 was an attempt by Pym to undermine alternative positive perceptions of the king. It passed the House of Commons by only a narrow majority. Now, if he's right, if Kevin was right, then Charles had everything to play for in the propaganda war of 1642. So there's an opening phase of the war before fighting breaks out, where we've got a papal war, propaganda war. The king's opening bid was, however, a notable failure. In January 1642, the Articles of High Treason against Pym and his fellow MPs charged them with trying to deprive the king of his legal power and wielding tyrannical power over his subjects. But they were also accused of endeavouring, by many foul aspersions upon his majesty and his government, to alienate the affections of his people and to make his majesty odious to them. The last charge accused them of having levied war against the king. So those are the charges. And Charles clearly understood the propaganda value of these accusations. He had them printed even before he went into the House of Commons to try to arrest the five members. But his failure to arrest them is often seen as the key cause of the Civil War. What is less often observed is the king's weakness in this initial phase of the paper war as well. Giles himself later acknowledged that his coming in person to the Commons had begot so unhappy a misunderstanding between him and his people. Having been forced to retreat from the House and then to leave Westminster, Giles began to retract what he'd done. And in subsequent printed messages to the Houses of Parliament, he waived his proceedings against the men. He informed Parliament subsequently that he would proceed in an unquestionable way against them and almost sought Parliament's aid in how to do that. Finally, in early February, he stated that he would wholly desist from proceedings against them. Now, at the same time, Charles continued to consent to bills sent to him by Parliament. He consented to the bill to exclude the bishops from the House of Lords and a bill for pressing soldiers for Ireland. In short, Charles had publicised his case against his opponents prematurely. He had then caved into Parliament's cries of breach of privilege, and his appeasement of his opponents only ended with his refusal to consent to the bill giving control of the militia to Parliament in early March. And he stressed that this was the first public bill we have refused this Parliament. So right up until March 1642, he was appeasing Parliament. But the militia became a sticking point for Charles. Without control over the forces levied in the counties, Charles believed that he would only be a titular king, a king in name only. There's no fighting force, no standing force, no standing army apart from the militia. So he consistently refused to relinquish the militia to Parliament unless it was for a short, specified period of time. On the scaffold, he claimed that he did not intend to encroach on parliamentary privileges, but that his privileges had been breached. It is the militia they began upon, he said. Now, Charles continued to make use of the printing press even after he left London, although the printing trade was concentrated in London. He took a printing press, his royal printer, with him to York, and this became the nerve centre of the royalist war effort against Parliament from March to August 1642. 78 royalist declarations and tracts were printed there by early September. The printer then followed the King to Shrewsbury by September, where he published a further 96 items by the following year, by August 1643. And by this time, 1643, Charles was able to make use of the university presses in Oxford, which had become his headquarters after the indecisive Battle of Edge Hill in October 1642. Charles printed various messages to Parliament warning that the passage of the militia ordinance without his consent was not binding on his subjects, and this became a plank in the royalist platform where Parliament was passing illegal ordinances without the King's consent. Charles also used the press to declare Sir John Hotham a traitor for not allowing him access to the arsenal in Hull in April. Similarly, Charles used the medium of print to refute the charge that he could be persuaded by anybody to embroil this kingdom in civil wars. Royal proclamations were also issued in print. Now, very strikingly, at the end of May, Charles accused Parliament of intending to depose him. So already he's saying there is an intention to get rid of the king. Parliament will become perpetual dictators over the king and people and leave him with the mere title of a king. Now, these were alarming claims given the hierarchical, patriarchal nature of this society, and they were designed to maximise support for the royalist cause from his subjects. And for Charles, the people were subjects. They were my people, my subjects, our subjects. He would find it very difficult, I think, to see them as autonomous, politically motivated individuals, and this is one of Charles's tragedies in the period. Now, the use of the printing press to address this audience beyond Parliament raises the question of who read these documents. And the answer is that some of them were surprisingly well circulated. Traditionally, proclamations were read aloud and then displayed in marketplaces. Other royal messages were ordered to be read and displayed in parish churches. So this catered both for the literate who could read and the illiterate who could not. Now, it's been estimated by David Cressy that in 1640, only 10% of women and 30% of men could read and write. Literacy in the period is difficult to assess, however, because many more people could read well enough but but couldn't write. They hadn't been taught to write. Now, for us today, that sounds quite extraordinary because we see the two skills as going hand in hand. But in the early modern period, if you didn't need to write, you wouldn't be taught to write more than perhaps just your signature. Now, we know that some clerics read royalist declarations from their pulpits. The pulpit is the broadcasting medium of the day, it's the BBC of the day. A Canterbury minister, John Marston, read a royal pamphlet to his parishioners in June. He then tried to put them off listening to a roll of parliamentarian pamphlets, which had been sent from Parliament and had been ordered to be read in churches. He claimed it's going to take 6 hours to read them. Now, at that point, he said, if you don't want to stay, you can go, and half the congregation scarpered. But the parliamentarians remained, sitting there bristling in their pews. And then, subsequently, they were outraged because it only took 90 minutes to read. What was he talking about? But this really tells us something, I think, about people in the 17th century, that they were willing to possibly sit and listen to somebody reading something for 6 hours, because there was no television, there was no radio, there was no daily newspaper. That's how you found out what King and Parliament were up to. And they were willing to sit and listen, or some of them were. In his messages, Charles recognised that parliamentarian propaganda was highly influential. He complained that the minds of many of our weak subjects had been poisoned by his opponents' pamphlets. In the same document, he warned that if Parliament could make laws without the King, then it could repeal old laws. Then he declared what would become of the long-established rights and liberties of the King and subject, and particularly of Magna Carta. So he's really piling it on, saying the Constitution is in danger. Charles was positioning himself as a defender of the rights and liberties of his people, which resided in the law. At the same time, he strongly refuted the image painted of him by Parliament as a tyrant. Instead, he accused Parliament of tyranny in passing ordinances without his consent. And in response to being branded a tyrant, Charles accused the parliamentarians of being rebels. But it wasn't until August the 24th that he actually formally declared war by raising his standard at Nottingham. Charles and his advisers then had worked very hard to present the royalist case in print. But the King also made his case in person. He addressed the gentry at York in May. In July, he spoke to the assembled gentry, freeholders and other inhabitants at Newark, then Lincoln and Leicester, where he appealed for horse, money and men. In September, he addressed his troops as they marched between Stafford and Wellington. Later that month, he spoke at Wrexham to the inhabitants of Denby and Flintshire. At Shrewsbury, he set up a mint, because the Royal Mint in the Tower of London, of course, was under parliamentarian control. In his speech at Shrewsbury, Charles asked for donations of silver and gold plate to make coins. Some of you may have seen the coins that were made in Shrewsbury. They were made to quite a high standard, and of course they're very rare collector's items today. In November, he similarly appealed in person to the inhabitants of Oxford and asked them for plate for the Royal Mint set up there. Yet Charles's speeches also reveal how very difficult it was for him to make a favourable impression on his subjects at this time. At Wrexham, he said that the sheriff would distribute copies of his speech, printed copies, because the Parliament had restrained the use of the press in London and the two universities. He couldn't use them anymore. He lamented the fact that only a few copies of his declarations would come to the view of my good people because of the craft and power of the Parliament. And he also acknowledged Parliament's contribution to the paper war. They have dispersed in print many notorious false scandals upon my actions and intentions. Now, interestingly, he also said he hoped that the people of Shrewsbury wouldn't regret his coming hither, for the presence of an army was not pleasant, he said. People would fear being robbed and spoiled, and he feared that he couldn't prevent all disorders committed by his soldiers. So he's well aware of the fact that he was coming at the head of an army. This didn't look good. So he pledged to do his best to restrain the disorders of the soldiers. Now, the conditions of war also made it very difficult for people to get access to the King, obviously. At York in August, he had complained that his subjects were threatened and forbidden to come near him by Parliament. Once war started, safe passages were necessary to cross the enemy lines. You needed to get a pass from a military commander, from Parliament, from the King. In February 1643, Sir Charles Barclay did just that. He obtained a safe pass from Parliament for one of his children to go from Somerset to Oxford to be touched for the king's evil. And the king's evil is a skin condition, largely a skin condition, can manifest other signs of illness, medically known as scrofula. It's the strain of TB. The idea that the king could cure the king's evil is based on the fact that the condition might have been misdiagnosed, or it might have gone into remission, it could go into remission. Now, as Kevin Sharp has emphasised, the ceremony of touching was an important aspect of royal ritual and divine kingship. It was evidence of the divine nature of royal power, and Charles was alert to its symbolism. And here we've got a touch piece. This has got a hole in it. The hole is made at the Royal Mint at the time of minting so that a ribbon could be strung through it and the piece could be worn around the neck, and the gold is touched by the king as he gives it to the person who's being healed, and then they wear it next to their skin and the king's touch affects the cure, apparently. So you can see it's a very fine piece of gold that people were given. When he became king in 1625, Charles changed the motto on the gold angel, the 10 shilling piece, given to those who were touched. The words now read, Amor populi praesidium regis. The love of the people is the king's protection. Now, Charles regulated the ceremony so that it was confined to a month at Easter and again at Michaelmas. This has been interpreted as evidence of his aloofness by Judith Richards, whereas Kevin Sharp has argued that it was part of a wider drive for order and decorum at the Caroline Royal Court. Now, with very little evidence, Richards also argued that after 1639, Charles became a much more assiduous stroker for the king's evil. And in March 1643, Charles prohibited his subjects from going to Oxford for the Easter ceremony of touching. The royalist newspaper, Mercurius Aulicus, approved of this decision because it was conducive to the health of Oxford and the safety both of the king and his sons. The report mentioned the infinite multitude of people, many very poor and indigent, who normally throng the court on that pretense. Well, if you could get a gold piece, you would, wouldn't you? Because people sold them. So, of course, there are other reasons for stopping people coming to the court during wartime. They might be parliamentarian spies as well, so good reason to stop. In the 1630s, Charles had touched hundreds of people during these ceremonies held in York, Durham, and Edinburgh. There's very little evidence, though, that the king performed this ceremony again until 1647, when it was handed to Parliament by the Scots after the Royalist defeat in the First Civil War. In February 1647, many diseased people came to see the king at Ripon. They brought their own ribbons and gold. I don't know how they knew to do this, but they brought their own ribbons and gold. At Leeds, hundreds were said to have attended the king for the same reason. Now, this suggests, at the very least, that there was a pent-up demand for the ceremony, that it hadn't been conducted for a while. Parliament immediately banned diseased people from visiting the king, because, of course, it was a way of showing your loyalty to the king as well. This measure was ineffective. In April, the parliamentary commissioners at Holdenby House complained of the great number of people going there to be touched by the king for the evil. A committee was set up by the House of Commons to prepare a declaration denouncing the healing ceremony as superstitious for the first time. So there's a reaction by Parliament against this as well. Yet in July, after Charles had been seized by the new model army, it was reported that the king had touched abundance for the king's evil and cured many at Caversham. Here, many loyal and faithful subjects resorted to the court, and many were admitted to the king's chamber to kiss his hand, to the king's joy. At Hampton Court in the autumn of 1647, Charles continued to touch those who came to see him for cures. And even at Carisbrook Castle on the Isle of Wight, people came from remote parts to be touched by the king. Charles's insistence on touching the sick in captivity has largely been ignored by political historians. It seems irrational, doesn't it? But it was the only royal power left to the king. It not only symbolised his divine right to rule because he cured by God's will, it was also a prerogative power of the king, of the crown, which Parliament simply couldn't claim. The only person who could do this is the king. It's not surprising that Parliament sought to debunk the ceremony as a superstitious belief. Now, in captivity, Charles also began to realise the extent to which the debates of the 1640s had swung the balance of power away from the crown. It was not just a question of Parliament gaining more power, but also of the people being seen as the source of political power by the new model army and by the levellers. In May 1646, Charles had fled Oxford and surrendered to the Scots, and he remained with the Scottish army at Newcastle until early in 1647. Now, in negotiating with his captors and with commissioners from the English Parliament, Charles began to understand the precise implications of the reform agenda that the Scots wanted to introduce into England. And you can almost sense in his letters the scales forming from his eyes. It's not just that he's fighting a civil war to regain his authority, but the agenda that the Scots and the English parliamentarians have got is really going to rob him of power. In May, he complained to the Queen that it was becoming daily clearer to him that the Scots wanted to clip the King's power in England as they had in Scotland. Henrietta Maria advised him to accept a Scots-style Presbyterian government in England, but Charles strenuously rejected this. He saw it as a pretext to take away the dependency of the Church from the Crown. And to him, this was as important as the militia for retaining royal power. For people are governed by the pulpit more than the sword in times of peace, he said. So it goes back to that idea that the pulpit is in fact incredibly important for getting the royal message across. This is the way that you get to people in the parishes and the localities. Presbyterianism, in contrast, would make me but a titular king. It would introduce that doctrine, he said, which teaches rebellion to be lawful, and that the supreme power is in the people, to whom kings ought to give account. So he's taking on board the political rhetoric of his opponents. And we have to understand that at this point in time, Charles was feeling increasingly isolated. And I think this explains why his negotiations with his opponents were both protracted and apparently inconsistent. Political historians look at what happens in the period from 1646 to 48, 49, and they say that Charles is untrustworthy, that he makes promises to one side, that he breaks his promise. But I think this is a man who has governed by taking advice from his Privy Council, from his favourites, from his Queen. He's very used to listening to other people. Now he's got to do it all on his own. In November, he confided to the Queen that there was no one at Newcastle he could negotiate with that he could trust. Understandably, his mood swung between optimism that he would settle his regal authority again and misery, sheer misery. At one point, one of his attendants noticed him crying privately in a corner of the room. He said he was crying teardrops that were so big and fat he'd never seen teardrops that size before. In January 1647, the Scots handed the King to a group of parliamentarian commissioners who took him south to Holdenby House with a guard. En route, many people flocked to see him with cries of joy and with their prayers for his preservation. But in July, the King had been dramatically seized at Holdenby by the new model army and taken to his house at Newmarket. By August, he had reached Hampton Court, where he was allowed briefly to live in state, but gradually this was reduced. And his escape in November to the Isle of Wight was triggered by a letter warning the King that some of the new model army political agitators had decided to put him to death. Now, whether this was by trial or secretly by assassination is not clear. Charles justified his escape by claiming that he feared for his personal safety, for his life. And he also maintained that the army aimed at the destruction of the nobility by taking away their negative voice in Parliament. The army also encouraged the doctrines of the levellers, he said, rather than punishing them. Now, these assertions raise questions again about when the trial and the execution of the King was first actively considered. John Lilburne, the leveller leader, had published Regal Tyranny Discovered in January of 1647. Now, it's not clear that Charles had read this, but obviously reports of what the levellers thought were filtering through, because in this tract, Lilburne argued that Charles deserved to be punished by Parliament more severely than Edward II or Richard II had been by their parliaments. So if you're talking about Edward II and Richard II, of course, the King is going to think about his assassination secretly and covertly. Andrew Sharp has argued that by the time of the Putney debates in 1647, the levellers were intent on punishing Charles and making the House of Commons the dominant power as the representative of the people. Now, similarly, John Morrill has argued very convincingly that Cromwell's views changed around about the end of October 1647, And this again followed the interception of letters revealing the King's agreement with the Royalist Scots, which led to the outbreak of the Second Civil War in 1648. Now, if this is the case, then Charles was absolutely right to fear for his life. He had planned to escape from Hampton Court to France, but no suitable ship could be found, so he headed instead for the Isle of Wight and his doom. There he continued to play his opponents against each other. Between 1646 and 48, early 49, he had negotiated with the Scots, the New Model Army, the Presbyterian and Independent parties in Parliament. And he promised them various things, seeking to divide and rule, to gain support, military support of the Scots and so on. But he'd also become convinced that a political settlement would strip him of power, dethrone him. He believed that he could only be restored to power at the head of an army. The defeat of the Royalists during the Second Civil War in the summer of 1648 left the way open for the New Model Army to bring Charles to trial. He was seen as that man of blood. In biblical terms, Charles was responsible for shedding the blood of his subjects by waging war on them, and now he was to be punished. Now, it seems to me that this blood guilt rhetoric is very clear. It's the Old Testament rhetoric. It's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Historians have tied themselves up in knots arguing about what it actually means. Does it mean bringing the king to trial and frightening him, making him back off because of the trial, and so on? Sean Kelsey, in particular, has argued that the trial of the king was an attempt by the army leadership to bring Charles to terms. It was set up as a way of forcing him to come to a settlement. The king's refusal to admit his crimes left the king's judges with no alternative but the death penalty. Now, Kelsey's thesis hasn't found widespread support. But even if he is right, the army had to contend with Charles's own views of how the court drama would play out. As early as December 1642, Charles had written to his Scottish cousin, the Duke of Hamilton. Now, this is 1642, December, the war has started. And in that letter he says, "I will either be a glorious king or a patient martyr." So Charles has already formed the idea that this is a struggle to the death in which he might have to die as a martyr. And I think even if Kelsey is right that the army, the MPs, wanted to bring Charles to trial and force him to concede, they had to contend with Charles's own view that he was willing to die to preserve royal power, and he was willing to be a martyr. Throughout the wars, Charles was aware that Parliament might ultimately take his life. On the 11th of January 1646, he told the Queen, "This Parliament, without doubt, determines with my life." And at times in captivity, Charles had thought that his life was in imminent danger. When he escaped from Hampton Court, for example, and later, when he was taken from Carisbrook to Hurst Castle before his trial. And when he went to Hurst Castle, he had hardly any attendants. His attendants were all dismissed. He only had one servant with him. He was incarcerated where he thought people wouldn't know where he was. And again, thoughts of Edward II and Richard II would have come to his mind. Charles I also feared that even if he did agree to further reductions of his powers, there was nothing to stop Parliament from killing him afterwards as well. Well before the trial, Charles had undoubtedly decided that he would rather die than leave his sons with a diminished crown. At his trial, Charles was charged with treason for waging war on the people of England. And against these charges, the king once more described himself as the defender of the liberties of the people of England against tyranny. At the trial, he's usually portrayed as not recognising the authority of the court and not attempting to defend himself, not pleading his case. I think that's wrong. I think if we read the transcript of the trial, he is making a very powerful case for himself as a defender of the people's liberties. I think he made a conscious attempt as well to debate the concept of the people's liberties with his opponents. But of course they kept trying to stop him. It's not a case of Charles refusing to talk, but at the moment when he chose to talk, they tried to stop him from speaking, because I think they could tell that what he said might strike a chord with all those subjects who'd come to see him, who'd been joyful when they'd seen him. Now, at one point during the trial, he was interrupted by Bradshaw, the Lord President of the court, who said, "You are not to have liberty to use this language." Now, I really think that that shows that the Parliamentarian Commissioners, and remember there were 135 of them, 80 of them sat in the court at any one time, I think they're really rattled at the way in which Charles is using the rhetoric of the liberty of the people, the freedom of the people. They try to stop him at that point. And the fact that Bradshaw says, you are not to have liberty to use this language, he's complaining about the language. It's not the fact that he's talking at all, it's the language that he's using. Now, on the scaffold, no one interrupted the king, who was able to make his final scaffold speech undisturbed. And he gave his final definition of the relationship between the crown and the people. The freedom and liberty of the people rested on government and law, not in having a share in government. A subject and a sovereign are clean different things, he said. And he said that the subject needs the king to defend their rights and liberties. Now, Charles had also been writing a defence of his actions in the Civil War since 1642. In 1648, his manuscript was prepared for the press by John Gordon, the future Bishop of Exeter. It was edited and approved by Charles on the Isle of Wight and published as the Icon Basilica. Now, again, there's been a big debate about how much of that book was actually written by Charles, what are his words, what are Gordon's words. Other clerics also seem to have been involved. One thing that I noted when I was looking at the source material to talk to you this morning was that in the Icon Basilica, the king's voice, it's presented as the king's voice is sometimes very derogatory about the people. Sometimes talks about the people being beasts or brute. Charles never does that. Even in his private letters to the queen, he never really denigrates his subjects in that way. He will talk about the apprentices in London being part of the weaker people, common people, but he never uses that kind of rather ugly, dismissive language. And I think this is where his clerical spin doctors have got hold of the manuscript and they've made it more pointed. So I think it'd be interesting to do a sort of word analysis on the book and see exactly where you think Charles's words are and where the clerical input is coming from. So this is the famous image of Charles from the Icon Basilica. Now, strikingly, this image depicts Charles as a royal martyr. And you can see here, there's all the iconography. You've got Charles' earthly crown at the bottom being trampled underfoot. You've got a crown of thorns in his hand, so there's the parallel with Christ being crucified. And then he's looking upwards to a heavenly crown. That's where his reward will be. And that's what he says in the scaffold speech. It's a very powerful piece of rhetoric, the scaffold speech. It says he goes from a corruptible crown to an incorruptible one. And on the left, you can see there's the rock that the ship of state is going to be shipwrecked on. Underneath that very cloudy scene on the top left, you've got the palm trees, the martyr's palm trees, a symbol of martyrdom. And those funny objects underneath are bells, and they're meant to summon people. So you've got the palm trees, symbol of martyrdom, and you've got Charles reading the Bible, the word of God, the truth. So it's a very powerful image. And of course, I've already spoken about the fact that people in the early modern period are not necessarily literate, they can't read and write, but they can recognise images and symbolism like this. This is exactly the sort of thing that they would have read instantly. For us, we need a certain amount of interpretation sometimes when we look at early modern images, especially if they've got biblical references, biblical texts in them. For people at the time, they would have been instantly recognisable, and there are very few words on that image. The whole thing is meant to appeal to the general public so everybody can see what the message is. So finally, to conclude, Charles's final, and I believe very conscious, gesture of self-sacrifice undoubtedly helped to preserve the royalist cause in the 1650s. But we shouldn't dismiss the influence of his appeals to his people in print, in person, and through the ceremony of touching in the 1640s, even if there was a gap in his ability to perform it. Charles's martyrdom may not have defended his people from the political uncertainties of the interregnum, but ultimately it did preserve both the Stuart monarchy and royal power from extinction, just as he had hoped. Thank you.